You.
Stew.
De.
De.
Ew.
Ew. Studio.
That's it.
Right? Studio.
360 with Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
Kurt Anderson.
I listen to it on the radio in my car.
Oh, don't be sniffy about
it. I'm not being sniffy.
I think you are.
No.
You've got a nose for it.
Oh, gosh. Wow. What are you saying over there?
Today on the show,
well-fed condo hustler.
Imagine the life of an utter, unrelenting ignoramus.
Shuttle-owning dilettante megalomaniac.
That's kind of amazing.
Keep listening. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. Stay. Sit.
Presidential nominees usually highlight their careers in public service to show how qualified they are to be president. Some were governors, some were senators. In the old days, some were war heroes. But one candidate took another path. The Republican nominee for president in 2016 is a decorated veteran of pro wrestling.
The hostile takeover of Donald Trump on Vince McMahon has happened at WrestleMania 23.
I didn't think he would do it.
Today on the show, we're talking about how we got to Donald Trump and the medley of cultural and political forces that set the stage for him to become the Republican nominee for president. I've been a student of Trump since 1986. At the time, he wasn't really well known, certainly not outside New York City. That year, Graydon Carter and I launched a magazine of satire and journalism called Spy. Our very first hire and chief deputy was Susan Morrison, who's now an editor at The New Yorker.
Hello.
Hi, you too.
Susan was there with us back in the 80s as we concocted and tried out various epithets for Trump.
Well-fed condo hustler. Ugly cufflink buff.
We actually said these?
Yeah. Shuttle-owning dilettante megalomaniac. This is my favorite. Joyless punk millionaire. Forbes 400 dropout.
Those
aren't they good?
Those are good. No, short-fingered vulgarian. It's funny that that's the one we decided on. I remember the short finger thing. That was based on Graydon's empirical observation of his fingers when he did his magazine profile of him before we ever started Spy.
I think that one probably stuck because we had empirical evidence that it upset Trump.
Yes.
Because he would circle pictures of his hands in gold Sharpie and send them to us. I think he continues to send them to Graydon.
He does 30 years later.
And again, the great thing about writing about Trump back then, it was so satisfying to know that we were getting under his skin. It was like bear baiting.
So a year ago, as the short fingers and small hands thing becomes like part of the national discourse.
It was unbelievable.
He had no problem with the word vulgarian. He called him a short-fingered vulgarian, and he's stuck on the fingers.
Who cares about Donald Trump's fingers?
So we say to Mr. Trump, keep your short fingers out of the Nevada housing market.
And Marco Rubio, for his 48 hours of trying to be funny, brought it up.
The next thing, now, the other thing he says, he's always calling me Little Marco. And I'll admit, the guy, he's taller than me, he's like 6'2", which is why I don't understand why his hands are the size of someone who's 5'2". Have you seen his hands? They're like this. And you know what they say about men with small hands?
He used it, and then Trump responded to it as though it was about his manhood. And,
right.
Which just grossed me out because I have said again, my most emphatic for-the-record insistence is that we never intended it to be about that.
No. We were actually kind of prudish about certain things like that. It wasn't a silly double entendre.
It was just a juvenile thing.
Gotcha.
The guy had short fingers.
Had weird hands.
Yeah. And then I think I actually did a spit take when I was watching the debate where it came up.
He hit my hands. Nobody has ever hit my hands. I've never heard of this one. Look at those hands. Are they small hands? And he referred to my hands. If they're small, something else must be small. I guarantee you there's no problem. I guarantee.
This isn't a debate for the nomination for the presidency.
And you know, there is an aspect of the fact that he took it up and kind of ripped the scab off and invited the whole press corps to dig back into Spy.
Yes.
You know, it's been nice that after 30 years, Spy has appeared in the press a lot in the last year. And I was reading one of these stories, I think from Bloomberg, and the reporter had crunched the numbers and calculated that Trump appeared 8.7 times in every issue of Spy.
Really?
Yeah.
That's nice to know.
So if you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato, knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously. Okay? Just knock the hell. I promise you, I will pay for the legal fees. I promise. I promise.
Bad boys, what you want?
It's still hard to fathom that Donald Trump is actually the Republican nominee, and a month from now may be elected president. It seems not quite really real. Is it reality television real or pro wrestling real? But then when I hold it up to the light, Trump's political success makes a kind of awful sense, because presidential politics have been morphing into entertainment since I was a kid.
I do not think it altogether inappropriate to introduce myself. I am the man who accompanied Jacqueline Kennedy to Paris, and I've enjoyed it.
1960, John F. Kennedy, young, dashing, witty, sexy. He'd also been a naval hero in the Second World War.
Oh, you don't want this, Mr. Kennedy. Believe me, I've been in this Navy. The worst thing you could do is let him trick you into an ocean.
Well, I can't ask for a transfer.
The actor Cliff Robertson playing JFK in the movie PP-109, with an actor named Lou Gallo playing one of his crew.
Of course you can. You got the juice. You got the pliers down there in Washington.
The juice?
Juice, muscle, glycerin. Don't they teach you any practical talk at Harvard?
It's an elective.
PP-109 came out in the summer of 1963 when Kennedy was in office. So you'd watch Walter Cronkite on the evening news talk about what the president did that day, and then you'd go out to the movies, buy your popcorn and milk duds, and watch the president depicted in a war movie.
Maybe it's not too late. Tell him you went psycho. You ate some poisoned meat. You woke up dizzy.
It's too late, Rogers, and I'm surprised at you. Where's your spirit?
But even more unsettling, the way Hollywood kowtowed to the White House to make that movie. Kennedy was actually allowed to choose the director and the actor who'd play him. His first choice was Warren Beatty, who passed on the role. And the studio even let the White House read the script and give notes on it before the film was shot. Remember, this is a president who just celebrated his 45th birthday on stage at Madison Square Garden with the ultimate Hollywood dream girl.
Happy birthday, Mr. President.
After JFK, it was kind of hard for other politicians running for president not to look lame, uncharismatic, miscast. But over the next few decades, politics adapted. And then, candidate Bill Clinton in 1992 on the Arsenio Hall Late Night Show, playing the sax and wearing Ray-Bans. Clinton didn't just sit down for an interview. He actually performed. And his whole presidency ended up being like a primetime melodrama. Sexual indiscretion, accusations of financial skullduggery, nearly overthrown. It was like an episode of Dallas. And with all those wild plot twists before and during his impeachment, Clinton's popularity actually rose, which paved the way for a new era of fictional presidents in movies and TV shows. Audiences came to expect to see the private dramas and demons of the leader of the free world.
I don't know how to address you. Would you prefer Jed or Mr. President?
To be honest, I prefer Mr. President.
This is Martin Sheen as President Jed Bartlett on The West Wing.
You understand why, right?
Do I need to know why?
It's not ego.
I didn't think it was.
There's certain decisions I have to make while I'm in this room. Do I send troops into harm's way? Which fatal disease gets the most research money?
Sure.
It's helpful in those situations not to think of yourself as the man, but as the office.
Then, Mr. President, it is.
Think about what's going on in that clip. It's Martin Sheen playing the role of a current president and talking in character about how to play the role of a president in office. If anybody understood that political leaders could and should play roles the way actors do, it was this guy.
Jack Warner of Warner Brothers, I'd been under contract for a number of years, heard that I was running for governor. I understood that he said, no, No, Jimmy Stewart for governor, Ronald Reagan for best friend.
Coming from the movies himself, he realized that the presidency was a form of movie, and that if you could successfully convert the presidency into a film, you could have the same kind of effect on an audience that a movie had.
That's the author and film scholar Neil Gabler. He wrote the book on how entertainment has come to reshape reality, including politics. It's called, appropriately, Life the Movie. I interviewed him at his house on Eastern Long Island.
I've lived here for 24 years, believe it or not.
And you'll even hear a few crickets and birds in his yard as we talk.
Maybe I shouldn't be living out here, but I am.
Reagan was, of course, the first time we elected an actor, a professional Hollywood actor, as president. And I want to play a clip of Reagan while he was president in 1985.
I have my veto pen drawn and ready for any tax increase that Congress might even think of sending up. And I have only one thing to say to the tax increasers. Go ahead, make my day.
Which is, of course, a Dirty Harry reference. People throw movie lines around, but Reagan did it a lot. And it had, it seems, more significance in his presidency, right?
Ronald Reagan was the first president who really understood that stagecraft wasn't just a part of the political process. After all, Franklin Roosevelt understood stagecraft and knew how to deploy it. Ronald Reagan was the first president who understood that stagecraft is the presidency. And the president wasn't really a politician. He was an actor.
Right.
And that notion of "It's Morning in America," his famous ad from 1984, he wanted to be the president of feel good. And that's what movies generally do, not all movies, obviously, but movies often leave us with a sense that all is right with the world.
It's morning again in America. And under the leadership of President Reagan, our country is prouder and stronger and better.
Who wouldn't want to go see a movie where it says, "Americans, it's morning in America"? Aren't you happy?
Yeah.
I mean, you want to enter that theater.
Right.
Reagan understood that if he could make Americans feel that way, it didn't make any difference what he did in terms of substantive policy. That policy fell by the wayside in terms of this larger psychological impulse that he could generate. He'd internalized the movies. He'd internalized entertainment.
Right.
He lived within it. It had in some ways colonized his own brain.
Yeah. It's really true, such as this moment I love from President Reagan's 1984 debate with Walter Mondale.
I think the people should understand that two-thirds of the defense budget pays for pay and salary, or pay and pension. And then you add to that food and wardrobe and all the other things, and you only have a small portion going for weapons.
I love that at the time. I love the wardrobe. We usually call them
that
uniforms.
Wardrobe budget. I'll tell you, that's what's killing us, is the wardrobe budget.
I know. Now, in our lifetime, who were the not so good performers as who were president?
I mean, Jimmy Carter clearly was, I think, a very poor performer. First of all, he didn't like the audience. You know, Kennedy seemed to like the audience. Obviously, Reagan loved the audience. Carter did not like the audience.
Right.
I mean, he was a Navy engineer. You know, what role are you going to cast a Navy engineer in?
Yeah.
These candidates are auditioning for a role. And I'll tell you, the movies have not done our presidential candidates any favors in terms of the way that they have portrayed heroism. Because, you know, the primary theme of our movies is the idea that an individual, through his own agency, can make everything right.
Right, right.
And that becomes part of our consciousness.
Right.
We're looking for a president who's going to be Batman.
Well, one of the paradoxes of Donald Trump is he is, as you say, all candidates must be performers. He's a guy who had his actual reality show training for more than a decade to get ready for this campaign. But it's his authenticity that is so attractive to the people who like him. He is simultaneously a pure reality show circusy performer, but whoa, he's being real. He's saying what we all think.
Well, he's playing within an American type. And that American type is basically, you know, the iconoclast. This is a long tradition in American entertainment, the person who doesn't abide by the social order. And so what he's doing very cleverly is he's merged two things. He's merged the entertainment type of the iconoclast with the idea of the reality television personality so that he is a real iconoclast.
Right, right.
One of the most interesting comments in this campaign was one I heard Mitch McConnell make, where he said that he approached Trump at the NRA convention, and he said to him, you know, you ought to read off a teleprompter. And Trump said to him, can't do it. I'd be boring.
Yes.
How many candidates have ever thought about the engine of their candidacy being not boring?
Yeah.
I don't think Hillary Clinton sits there and says, am I going to be boring today?
I don't think so. So if Donald Trump becomes President Trump, what are the implications in terms of the performative show business aspects of the presidency?
Well, we're going to have a presidency that follows the contours of Reagan in the sense that it's going to be a movie, but the movie is a very, very different movie than the one that Ronald Reagan presented, which right. was a genial, uplifting kind of film. You know, this would be 4 years of a very angry, resentful kind of movie. When you see vengeance on the screen, it's on the screen and it stays there. Vengeance in real life in the office of the presidency is another thing entirely. 50 years from now, historians are going to look at this period and they're going to be scratching their heads and wondering, how in the world did this happen? And the answer will be entertainment. That's how it happened.
Coming up.
Well, I felt the character of Will Smith's girlfriend, the beautiful stripper, could have been developed more.
What if Bill Clinton had a side gig as a movie reviewer?
Does she have friends? Are they also strippers? And if they are, why doesn't she bring her stripper friends to meet the president?
How Saturday Night Live and Comedy Central have defined presidential comedy. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Studio 360.
Today on the show, the entertainer-in-chief. How show business and presidential campaigns and the presidency got all smooshed together.
Trying to figure out what flavor frozen yogurt the Veep should get.
One of my favorite shows on TV right now is Veep. There's one episode where the vice president is planning a photo op at a frozen yogurt shop, and she and her advisors have to make a crucial decision before they go.
The Jamaican rum flavor.
That's a really strong flavor choice. I mean, it's unexpected, it's funky, it's kind of sexual.
Yeah, I don't want to make too quick of a decision. Let's consider other flavors, like vanilla.
Oh, come on. Vanilla has girl's flavor.
That's comedy, of course, but there actually are advanced men and advanced women who do plan out every detail of a politician's every moment in public. Hi, I'm Kurt.
Josh, how are you, Kurt?
Good to meet you. Josh King used to be one of those people. He worked in the Clinton White House, and now he has written a book called Off Script, An Advanced Man's Guide to White House Stagecraft, Campaign Spectacle, and Political Suicide. I met up with him at the very location where a certain candidate announced his candidacy for president last year. So here we are in front of Trump Tower in a sunny day in Midtown Manhattan.
They haven't arrested you yet.
No, well, of course, I'm half hoping that the security teams will swarm around us and throw us out. You were an advance guy, worked for the Dukakis campaign, then in the Clinton White House. What does an advance guy do? People know that phrase, but I'm not sure they really understand the intricacies of it.
Well, I mean, if you think about in terms of how Bruce Springsteen puts on a rock concert, it's not just the boss walking out with his guitar. there's a huge army of roadies, people who think through what his tour schedule is going to be, where his stage is going to be set, what the song list is going to be. All these have parallels in politics.
Yeah. We'll go inside, if they let us. And we're passing here a guy selling, I guess he counts as a protester, a guy selling a Trump toilet plunger and toilet paper. I don't think he's authorized by the candidate.
Cooler in here.
It is. I remember when it went up, it seemed so shiny, so much shiny gold chrome and pink marble, and I guess the rest of the world has caught up. It seems kind of normal these days.
Totally normal.
If you were his advance man and looking at, okay, Josh, we're going to do this announcement next week, what would you say?
It's a really tight, small venue.
Right.
But it served its purpose perfectly, because you realize that it's not so much about what these few hundred people, some of whom were actually paid $50 to be able to show up here.
Now, did that surprise you, that report that they just sent out a call for actors to pay them $50 to be supporters?
Well, it's Fifth Avenue and 57th Street. I mean, it's either that or tourists anyway. But that wasn't the point. You needed them as props to fill that 45-foot gap between your stage and the bank of cameras and to applaud on cue. Better to have them trained than to have any random public.
Should we go to the location? Passing, of course, the Ivanka Trump shopfront selling her jewelry.
It's like their little Disney World of their family history.
So we are in a kind of, I don't know, 10-story atrium space with sunlight coming in through windows at the top, and this complex of several escalators, lots and lots and lots of marble. Hey, the Trump bar immediately to our right, and a currency exchange straight ahead. Although it's small, there's a lot of space where cameras can go, where people can be. I would think, in terms of getting shots, it wouldn't be difficult to have people with video cameras wherever you need them.
No, and all you needed was a small bank to get the head-on shot. You need to provide for a dozen cameras or so. There was going to be plenty of time in the rest of the campaign for more ambitious stagecraft.
Right.
This was basic. Trump, podium, bank of flags, announcement by Ivanka, embrace with Ivanka. I can give my 45-minute speech. Then the family can be brought back on stage for what we call a family photo, and you're done. You're out of here. The news networks have so much material to work on for that evening and then into the morning.
Now, coming down the escalator was remarked upon at the time as a kind of unorthodox way to go, and it did look strange. He's passive. He's standing there with this slow-moving escalator. It looked kind of ridiculous to me. Was that a bad idea?
It gives new definition to Deus Ex Machina, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, the whole idea of a walk-in or an entrance is one of the basic ingredients of a major political event. Now, if you think about the practical constraints you're in here at Trump Tower, how else are you going to show the grand movement toward the stage, whether you happen to be stationary on the escalator or not?
Right.
So they start the soundtrack, Neil Young's Rockin' in the Free World. They come down the escalator. And think about it. It gives about 15 seconds of camera tracking to let the correspondent say, after they've been tossed the story by David Muir or Scott Pelley or Lester Holt, Donald Trump announced his candidacy today by arriving at Trump Tower. Cut to tight shot of the major sound bites they want to take for that story.
It's just a dude in a suit riding an escalator. I don't know. I feel like I would have tried to persuade him, like, well, Mr. Trump, why don't we turn the escalator off? You run down and show how energetic you are or something. I don't know. And, oh, here, I didn't even see. Behind me all this time has been the Donald J. Trump signature collection, a shirt-tie combination that looks like a museum of the 1980s.
It does. It absolutely does. And
you know, white collar and the striped shirt and his fragrances.
His array of books written with other
by
Tony
other,
Schwartz.
By other people, according
Trump,
to Tony
Trump, the art
Schwartz.
Of the deal, yeah. Exactly.
Oh, a hoodie. That's interesting. A Trump hoodie.
The camo version of the Make America Great Again hat.
Oh, and does that say, let's see, the label of this Trump
Made in
shirt.
Bangladesh. You can see it right there.
Now, you'd think they would just get a different one. Or I guess if they removed it or didn't show it, that would then become a story. But That's kind of amazing. Mr. Anti-Trade, Make It in America, has that Made in Bangladesh tag right here. Shall we go out back to the other atrium where we don't have all this jangly sound? It's interesting, looking at the conventions this year, Donald Trump is a show business figure, has been for decades. And he talked about, oh, conventions, political conventions are so boring. We're going to give real showbiz pizzazz to this one. Man, just judged on show business pizzazz, the Democratic convention won, right?
By a landslide. I mean, just think of the mileage that Secretary Clinton got for weeks by the appearance of Kazir Khan and his wife on the stage on the Thursday night that she gave her speech. No one probably knew in advance, maybe they did, maybe they didn't, that Mr. Khan would pull out a $1 copy of the Constitution and hold that up as a prop. But that became the front page picture and the enduring picture of Mr. Khan's message. And for all of the millions of dollars that were spent on construction and stagecraft of either the Wells Fargo Arena in Philadelphia or the Quicken Loans Arena in Cleveland, a $1 copy of the Constitution became an enduring message of the convention.
Josh King, thanks so much. This has been great.
My pleasure, Kurt.
People like Josh King obsess over making sure that presidential candidates look and sound their best on screen. Of course, comedy writers do pretty much the opposite of that. They study candidate shortcomings and then distill jokes out of those. But for a while now, something odd has been happening there.
What happens if you become pregnant? Are we going to be stuck with Tim Kaine for 9 months? How does this work?
I could send you some pamphlets.
Politicians like Hillary Clinton have managed to get in on the jokes. I asked Eric Molinsky to take a look at this part of the morphing of entertainment and politics in America.
Comedy and politics have become so intertwined, it's easy to forget that there was a time when they're in completely different worlds. Sure, comedians made cracks about the president, but the presidents mostly stayed above the fray. A big exception was 1968. Richard Nixon had been the butt of many jokes. He once said after losing an election,
"You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore."
And then Nixon went on laughing.
"Oh, no. I don't think we could get Mr. Nixon to stand still for a sock it to me."
"Sock it to me?"
It was not good.
Allison Dagnes is the author of A Conservative Walks Into a Bar, The Politics of Political Humor. And while Nixon's delivery was painfully awkward, Dagnes gives him credit for just showing up and being a good sport.
If you look at the early days of television, any of the old ads, the Adlai Stevenson ads, oh, those are painful to watch.
"Thanks to television, I can talk to millions of people that I couldn't reach any other way."
We're so used to politicians being good at this now that when it was a new medium, it was very untested. People didn't know what to do.
Live from New York, it's Saturday night!
When Lorne Michaels launched Saturday Night Live in 1975, you wanted to put politicians on the show regularly. But the writer Jim Downey says the politicians were skittish. In fact, he and another writer, Robert Smigel, once pitched a sketch to New York City Mayor Ed Koch.
"It was a really funny idea. It was like a get tough program for graffiti artists. And you want to tag the subway or do your graffiti. Guess what? Right underneath it, we're going to write sucks." And so Koch said, "I'm not going to say sucks. I'm not going to say that."
A few years later, they tried the same pitch on Rudy Giuliani.
"Instead of being Mr. Cool, everyone's going to think you suck.
For two-time offenders, our trained staff of police artists will make it look like you wrote it. And for three-time offenders, we're going to put sucks big time."
Early on, SNL became known for its devastating impersonations. And they weren't all great mimics, but the SNL impressions had real satirical bite. When Norm Macdonald was hosting Weekend Update, Jim Downey wrote a series of sketches where Bill Clinton, played by Daryl Hammond, reviewed movies whenever the president was the main character. And in two of these movies, the First Lady had died.
Norm was like, "Wow, Mr. President, you really liked it. So what was your favorite thing?" It was, "The Dead Wife."
Well, getting back to the film, Mr. President, was there anything that you didn't like?
Well, I felt the character of Will Smith's girlfriend, the beautiful stripper, could have been developed more. We never learn much about her. For example, does she have friends? Are they also strippers? And if they are, why doesn't she bring her stripper friends to meet the president? After all, his wife is dead.
After Monica Lewinsky, that joke might have seemed obvious or piling on. But this was a few years earlier.
It, to me, was more fun at the insinuation that we were basically saying, come on, you know this is going on.
Jim Downey also worked with Daryl Hammond when Al Gore was running for president.
Because I had watched Gore a lot and I saw some things there that I would talk to Daryl about. His phraseology, I remember there was one thing in the piece I wrote, my plan, Jim, is different.
Rather than squander the surplus on a risky tax cut for the wealthy, I would put it in what I call a lockbox.
Sort of the way you would talk to a child.
The real Al Gore was right. The Bush tax plan did turn the surplus into a deficit. But the Gore impersonation also reinforced what a lot of people were thinking when they were watching the real debate. This guy's kind of weird. Many people, including Will Ferrell, who played opposite Daryl Hammond as George W. Bush, said that those sketches may have swayed voters away from Gore.
The only pole I care about is the North Pole, and that is melting. It's
not. Politicians want to get in on the joke and not be the butt of it. And that's why Sarah Palin appeared next to Tina Fey when she was doing her uncanny Palin impersonation.
I do want to take this opportunity to say, live from New York, it's Saturday night!
Allison Dagna says, SNL goes for those personal quirks, which could sway swing voters, not policy positions.
Most people really don't care about politics. If you're looking at the biggest politicians in America, in order to make fun of them, you have to pick on the things that are most understandable and recognizable to the voting public.
But then Comedy Central came along and showed that even something like the tax code could be hilarious.
You managed to talk about a tax hike as a spending reduction. That's like saying, I'm not going on a diet. I'm going to add calories to my excluded food intake.
The audience for The Daily Show is smaller, but fiercely loyal. And Jon Stewart was able to turn semi-obscure politicians like Mitch McConnell into major targets. Also, Jon Stewart thought the Senate Majority Leader looked like a turtle.
Sure wouldn't want to startle folks with any sudden movement.
Something with a stronger point of view will often make more of an emotional connection with somebody.
Steve Bodo has been a producer and writer on The Daily Show for 14 years.
Things that get passed around in social media are, sometimes they're just about funny, but more often I think people like to pass around things that merely make them feel something. And so comedy with a strong point of view will hit that button, I think, more often.
But he does worry about preaching to the choir. In fact, a lot of political comedians and writers dread something they call clapter. That's when the audience claps more than it laughs because you made a point they agree with.
Occasionally we get that clapter, and we usually, when it happens, we sort of look over at each other and like raise our eyebrows like, didn't know that was going to happen. Like, it's hard to predict which lines are going to get that.
The biggest surprise in political comedy happened during the 2008 election. At a fundraiser, then-Senator Barack Obama didn't just tell a few jokes. He killed.
It is an honor to be here with Al Smith. I obviously never knew your great-grandfather, but from everything that Senator McCain has told me, the two of them had a great time together before Prohibition. So,
I think Obama is probably our funniest president.
Again, Jim Downey.
He's funny in a very unusual way for a politician, which is he perfectly happy to do dry, to do deadpan, which scares the bejesus out of most politicians because they need to be certain that everyone's going to know that it's a joke. And when you do deadpan, there's always that risk, you know, that someone's going to go, I can't believe he said that.
when Obama got hammered by the press because of the disastrous rollout of healthcare.gov, he sidestepped the mainstream media and made his case to uninsured young people on Zach Galifianakis' web series, Between Two Ferns.
I have to know, what is it like to be the last black president?
Seriously? What's it like for this to be the last time you ever talked to a president?
It must kind of stink.
Daily Show producer Steve Bodo was impressed. Obama nailed his part as the straight man.
There's a lot of politicians who aren't accustomed to not getting in the way of what other people are trying to say. And that's also a skill that I think he has.
And the president knows his stuff, y'all. That's why they call him the POTUS, which means person on top. What is it?
Jimmy, POTUS stands for President of the United States.
He's the POTUS with the most stuff.
We have come a long way from Nixon's awkward appearance on Laugh-In. But are things getting a little too cozy? I mean, isn't the point of political comedy to challenge politicians, especially the president?
John used to say, you know, when we leave here with no friends.
You can see clips of those political sketches at studio360.org. Eric Malinsky brought us that story.
Have you ever played the board game Sorry?
No, I sort of like Monopoly better than
Sorry. Before Donald Trump was yucking it up and getting petted by Jimmy Fallon, The Apprentice made him a TV star. But exactly how is that working out for us?
Reality television is very much a part of the poison dose that America took that allowed Trumpism to occur.
MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell on how a TV genre warped the electorate. Still to come on Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and you're listening to Studio 360.
And I'm Kurt Anderson. Our program today is about how show business and politics have merged into a single government entertainment industrial complex and reshaped what it means to be a presidential candidate and president. Also, how to sound like one.
I don't know. It's a terrifying voice.
My name is David Carl. I'm an actor. I'm an improviser. I also do impressions.
Hi, I'm Gary Busey, and I've come here to change your life.
Jeb Bush.
I think it's been a very difficult campaign.
Yeah, I know, Bernie, but it's very hard for me to whisper. I really don't know how.
So I started doing Donald Trump a year ago. It's a weird mix of sounds and parts of your mouth and...
It's this weird thing at the back of the mouth, but it's also at the front. It's something like this. I mean, but he also does this. You know, he goes up and he goes down. I don't think so. You know, it's sort of all over the place. It's basically like he's assaulting you with his entire mouth.
It's the cadence of someone who wants to control the room. So if he started really blustery, just when someone's thinking he's blustering too much, he might change it to something, you know, and it really is sad. Isn't it sad? So sad. And then he plays the victim a lot. He likes to play the... Oh, I mean, you know, the media, they're so hard on me. They're so tough on me. And then immediately switches to the aggressor, right? And New York Times, I can tell you, I'm coming after you. I'm coming for you. It's really weird because he says, by the way, when things aren't connected, like he'll be, by the way, nobody's better with clean coal than me. I love clean coal. By the way, China is great. By the way, they are going to pay for the wall in Mexico. It's going to be the Great Wall of Mexico. And he would just go all the way around the barn. I do have to make sure – I find myself talking like him, you know, with my friends. I have to make sure that I'm not over-talking. I have to take breaks. People ask me all the time, oh, don't you hope he wins so you can play him? I'm like, no, absolutely not. I have a gig playing him until November 8th, and I would love it if that was the end of it.
I'm going to make it worse.
Story.
American politics has never seen anything quite like the Donald Trump for President show.
Most people know Lawrence O'Donnell as the host of The Last Word every night on MSNBC. But earlier in his career, he worked as a top aide to Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan and as staff director for the Senate Finance Committee. He's also fictionalized that world. He was a writer on The West Wing, and he created an NBC show about the Senate called Mr. Sterling. So, Lawrence, as both this analyst of politics every night on a news channel and this storyteller who makes up political characters and plots, let's say you're writing a script with a Donald Trump character in it.
which no one ever did.
Well, exactly.
No one imagined it. He has shamed fiction writers.
So let's imagine he hasn't happened yet, and you're writing this script. You're creating him. How do you introduce him with those little telegraphic ways that script writers say who this guy is?
I think the very first words that you would hear him say, no matter what the setting was, the very first words would be, "To tell you the truth." The very first words, which is an invention of salesmen. Human beings don't use it. We don't say, "To be honest with you," which Donald Trump does in every paragraph.
I mean, to be honest with you. I mean, to be honest with you. You know, to be honest with you.
To be honest with you.
It's to be honest with you.
And no other politicians do, by the way, because they understand the implication. That if I say to you now,
"To be honest with you,
to be honest,
to be honest with you,"
that I have to be honest, okay?
It means what I just said, I wasn't being honest. So this is the moment,
yeah.
Right? So forget the previous paragraph because I didn't put that in there.
Right. That's interesting. The salesman playing for time is an interesting. That's who that character is.
Oh, absolutely, it is. It's no. This character exists. You know,
David Mamet plays
at every used car lot in America. Salesmen became salesmen by hanging around other salesmen, and that's how Donald Trump did it, by hanging around his father, who was
right.
The same thing.
Right.
And they all sound that way.
A character like Donald Trump, not just that part of him, but the whole package, that really – I can't imagine such a character being written into The West Wing.
And here is why. The character is not believable. If you came into The West Wing writer's room and said, "Here's who I want to create as the Republican candidate for president," I would be the first. I'd be as polite as I could. I'd let you go on for a full 3 minutes. And then I would say, "That's impossible. No one will vote for this person." And the problem for our audience is that they won't believe it. And we needed our audience to believe that this could happen.
Although, hasn't the parameters of the real world of politics been really changed, maybe forever, by Donald Trump?
Yeah. The reason we all in the pundit world underestimated the possibility of the Trump candidacy, we wildly underestimated the racist vote in America, and we wildly underestimated the uneducated vote in America, the people Trump affectionately calls the poorly educated. And what I mean by the uneducated, this goes across – it goes across resumes, okay? It includes people who went to college. We have now in America a mass inability to separate fact from fiction.
Exactly. And we've had reality television for 15, 20 years now sort of tutoring people in blurring that.
Yeah. Reality television is very much a part of the poison dose that America took that allowed Trumpism to occur. We obviously – one of the things that we didn't understand at the beginning of the Trump campaign was we underestimated the corruption – of public thinking that reality TV has delivered. And reality TV is the cynical epicenter of Hollywood. It is the most cynical exercise show business has ever engaged in. Let's take these people you'd never want to live beside, like the Kardashians. Let's take the guy who fires people, the guy who everybody in the world hates, the guy who fires people. Let's give those people shows and let's say it's fun. And then also the fact that, you know, the firing people was made a game. You know, it wasn't real people.
Right.
It wasn't, you know, you fire Gary Busey. Okay. You know, I guess maybe there's something funny about that.
Yeah.
You know, so it was done completely as a game, except to Donald Trump, who has lived a life of falsity his entire life. And so when he was sitting in that boardroom, he probably never felt more powerful in his life, that he
right.
got to fire Gary Busey on meat or
meat. And it club. Was in his Trump Tower where that took place.
Yeah.
So if you're today making a show about
a female president of the United States, Hillary Clinton is the sort of person that conventionally and traditionally would have been cast as that, right?
Hillary Clinton has been on the presidential stage longer than any presidential candidate in history. She entered the presidential stage in 1992. America started watching the Clinton presidential TV series 24 years ago, and that's too old a TV series.
Right.
So before you get to, you know, we don't trust her or what she might have done or not done over the years to invite suspicion about her, her biggest problem is audience fatigue. That's her biggest problem.
Right. So losing presidential candidates tend to fade into the background after the election they lose. But Trump clearly just feeds off of all attention and the attention of this campaign. If he loses, what's that going to be like for him, do you think?
You know, for most of them, it is a real emotional shock when those cameras get packed up and disappear. And they are adrift in a way that is profound. With Trump, there is going to be a certain amount of relief because he knows that, aha, today I won't be asked a single question that I don't know the answer to. You know, imagine the life of an utter, unrelenting ignoramus every day being confronted with their own ignorance about everything, tax policy, international trade, all these things all day long. We're going to remove that burden from the life of Donald Trump. There will be a certain amount of relief to that.
Lawrence O'Donnell, it's been a great and illuminating pleasure. Thank you.
I could go on and on. Thank you very much.
Lawrence O'Donnell is the host of The Last Word on MSNBC. And now, the last word for me in this hour. I've been thinking a lot this last year about a movie directed by Mike Judge. It's an over-the-top dystopian comedy called Idiocracy. In Idiocracy, the president of the United States is a crazed, narcissistic, entertaining, former porn star and professional wrestler.
I know Baron, with all that starving bullshit and the dust storms, and we running out of french fries and burrito coverings.
Yeah.
But I got a solution.
That's what you said last time.
The movie is set 500 years in the future, when Americans have been severely dumbed down by centuries of terrible, trashy entertainment. Earlier this year, the co-writer of Idiocracy, Eitan Cohen, tweeted, "I never expected Idiocracy to become a documentary." That's it for this week's show. We've got a lot more stuff in our podcast feed, including a longer version of my conversation with my old spy colleague, Susan Morrison.
Is he going to have us killed now?
Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frassica,
Krista Ripple,
Sam Kim,
Skylar Swenson,
Tommy Bizzaria,
Zoe Saunders,
Gabriella Cortez,
Judy Gu,
Jackie Harris.
And I'm Kurt Anderson. Thank you very much for listening.
We're going to make public radio great again. And by the way, it's not going to be free anymore. It's going to be like HBO. It's going to be more expensive. You're going to have to pay.
Is it too late now to say sorry? Because I'm missing more than just your body. Is it too late now
to say sorry? PRI. Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, a band that combines their music with fragrance.
We blindfolded the audience and dispersed the scent for each song.
It's indie rock in Smell-O-Vision. Snowblink plays live in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. We could fly.